Yeah, peace and blessings, love and service. I want to thank you all, listening audience, everyone chiming in. Definitely want to thank my supporters, Restorative Justice, NERC, which is Northside Residents Redevelopment Council, SEIU, Local 26, the Union, Nonviolent Peace Force, and BWWA for supporting this podcast, which is the 3D Restorative Solutions Podcast. You know, and had a conversation with a gentleman by the name of Mel Duncan, and I record the conversation. I just want to segue, first of all, to thank all the listening audiences for chiming in, my supporters, and I really want to get right down into this conversation with Mel, so I segue over to that, and thank you again. So, and I want to kind of smoothly segue, organically segue into this. So I want to welcome all the listening audiences and everybody tuning in to this special edition of 3D Restorative Solutions. And I think that, and I want to go back because in earlier podcasts that are up and they're on all podcast platforms, earlier this summer, I went through a training program, and I know a lot of times I talk about restorative practices, restorative models, restorative justice, restorative this and restorative that. And that's something that I've invested myself in. But this summer I was told about and actually went through, sacrificed my time to go through a training, which anybody who knows me knows that I'm big on training, going through trainings and personal development, professional development. I really do believe that that's what actually gives us more tools to be able to do what we really want to do, is continuing down the path of learning. So in my path, in my journey, I came across some information about Nonviolence Peace Force. And I was told about it, and individuals like, hey, they got a training coming up. You kind of one of those guys who, like, you know, that's always about learning. And I said, yeah, because I really do believe that it's individuals who stay engaged are the ones who come up with the solutions to our social issues, right? So in my staying engaged, went through the training, and actually just hearing about the training, I didn't understand what, you know what I'm saying? From my mindset, it's like Nonviolence Peace Force. Okay, there's no oxymorons in there. It's no, you know what I'm saying? It's a little jazzy, right? But, you know, I'm interested in knowing more because at the same time, and we know this is in the time of 2020, the time of COVID-19 and social distancing, the highlighting and the exposure of a lot of disparities and a lot of social illnesses, along with the murder of George Floyd and the exposure of a lot of issues with not only the police force, but the unions and how communities are feeling protected, right? So with that, the Nonviolence Peace Force, what I wanted to do was bring in someone who I had the pleasure of meeting, the honor of meeting, actually sitting in a room, listening to the wisdom from his perspective. So I wanted to bring Mr. Mel Duncan on, and I want to allow you to introduce yourself. But I did want to kind of give from my understanding, because, and this is, you know, has everything to do with the conversations and the narrative that's taking place now around defunding the police, communities having trust in the police or the forces that occupy their communities. And, you know, what is it that we can do, like, moving forward? And that was my reason for participating, to find out what else is there that I can do to provide my community with the tools. So One, first, I want to thank you, Mr. Duncan Mell, for coming in and sharing with me this time, because time is something that we can't get back. But investing our good in the time means that our future, you know, can be brighter, if not only for us, but for someone else, right? So if I can get you to introduce yourself.
It can be.
Yes, and it can be. And it can be, right? And it can be. So, Mr. Duncan, right. If you can introduce yourself, give you time, and, you know, you got the floor.
Okay. Well, thank you, Manu. It's an honor for me to be on the podcast for the 3D Restorative Solutions. Because, you know, since the beginning of the pandemic, people have been saying, I can't wait till we go back to normal. And we aren't going back anywhere. You know, normal's changed. And also, there are those who come forward and saying, this is a war. This is a war on the virus. Well, we've all seen how when you declare war on inanimate things, like, how's the war on terrorism worked out for us? Or how's the war on drugs? We know what happened then. And so this whole metaphor of declaring war on things hasn't worked. Mm. And instead, people are also stepping forth and are creating a new story. And that's what's so important about what you're doing, Manu, with the restorative justice, because that's an important piece of a new story. And it's not new.
No, it's not new. It's not new. Right, exactly. Yeah,
in fact, the Bemba people in what is now Zambia were practicing what we now call restorative justice a couple hundred years ago. And so when we look at the roots of whether it's restorative justice or unarmed civilian protection, we find that it's deeply rooted. As Gandhi would say, nonviolence is as old as the hills. And, you know, we basically live nonviolent lives.
Yes.
You know, there's ruptures to that. Mm-hmm. There's exceptions. Yeah. But most of our day, we're living nonviolently. I used to live in New York, and I was invited to talk to some students. And so I took the subway to get there. And, you know, these were young students, and they knew everything. And, you know, they were giving me a hard time. And, you know, nonviolence doesn't work, and so on and so forth. And I finally said, look, I took the subway to get here. If our species wasn't basically nonviolent, none of us would have got work. The subway just wouldn't work.
Right.
And it's, but there are times that we do resort to violence, and then that violence is amplified by people who want to make money off it.
Right.
And so it takes a bigger space in our psyche than it actually is.
Indeed.
And that's not to say that violence doesn't exist, because it does. It's yes. real. It hurts and it kills people.
Yes.
Nonviolent Peace Force is invited to war zones to provide direct protection for people who are under threat of violence, of war. And we, using well-trained individuals from throughout the world. In fact, Manu, I hope we can snatch you up sometime. And we directly protect civilians who are caught up in the war, because civilians are the major casualty of war.
Right.
And that's not an accident.
No.
That's done on purpose.
Right.
And we work with local communities on how to prevent further violence.
Right, that part.
This is working in places like South Sudan, Colombia, Iraq, Myanmar, the Philippines, and I can go on.
Right.
It's been proven. It does work. And we don't need to bring in a bunch of guns when people are faced with violence.
You know what? Can you touch on that a little bit? Because I think there's some misconceptions. And if it was put on the billboard, there'd be a lot of argument on that statement. Mm-hmm. Right? So can you kind of tap into that a little bit? Like the wisdom of that.
Yeah. Let me tell you two stories.
Okay, great.
We have about 160 nonviolent peacekeepers who live and work in South Sudan right now, and they're all over the country. I worry a lot about COVID, but interestingly, there's less COVID per capita in South Sudan, a lot less than there is in the United States.
Yeah, I can believe it. You know what? Certain leadership causes things, right?
And so they have been involved in providing protection for a brutal civil war that reignited at the end of 2013. Tens of thousands of people have been killed. Several million have had to flee. I think it's 7 million people right now are on the brink of starvation. And they try to say, oh, that's those Africans in another tribal war. It's not. This is two billionaires fighting it out for power. And they ethnicize it. They'll manipulate. But in the end, it's these two guys, and they want revenge, they want power, and they want more money. And so tens of thousands of people suffer. So that's where we are with the people who are being hurt by the violence. So we had two of our peacekeepers, a guy named Derek from England and a guy named Andreas from Mexico.
Okay.
And they were in this camp where people had fled.
Okay.
And without notice, you know, there was a big berm, you know, hill kind of guarding off the camp. A group of rebels came storming over and started shooting people point blank. And so Andreas and Derek were with 14 women and children. So they went to a hut and they stood in the doorway. And on three occasions, these young rebels with shiny new AK-47s, and I can guarantee you,
right,
those were imported. There's lots of people in the global north who get rich off these conflicts. Yep. No AK-47 is manufactured in South Sudan.
Not a one.
And so the young rebels stuck the gun. Two of them had guns and one had a machete. And said in very profane terms, you know, get out of here. Mm-hmm. You don't belong here. We want the people in the hut. And that happened three different times during this battle. And each time Derek and Andreas held up their nonviolent peace force identity badge and calmly said, we're unarmed. We're here to protect civilians and we will not leave. After the third time, the rebels quit coming. And when they went down to join their colleagues, Andreas and Derek could hear them say, stay away from up there. Don't go up there. Mm-hmm. And in a debrief afterwards, Andreas was very clear. He said, you know, if we would have had a gun, we would have been killed.
Exactly.
But because we didn't, we changed the equation.
Gotcha.
And that's how it works. If you're there, committed to nonviolence, not trying to dominate anybody, not trying to control them.
Right.
But our ability to protect is based upon three things: relationships, communication, and community. Whereas if you got a gun, your ability to protect is based upon dominance and threat.
Yep.
So it's a different equation.
Right, right. So, and I guess the question would be, you know, what got you into doing the work that you do?
I hope this is about a 4-hour.
Hey, you know, we can make it in a couple parts, man. That's the good thing about technology today, right?
Yeah, you know, in late 1983, there was a war going on against the government of Nicaragua, which had been a Marxist revolutionary government that had taken power from a brutal dictator.
Okay.
Who the U.S. had supported multi-generations of the same family.
Oh, okay.
And they were filthy rich, and most of the people of Nicaragua were poor and dying. And so this group called the Sandinistas took power.
Okay.
And they set up the government, and one of the first things they did was a literacy campaign.
Okay.
And then they divided up land so everybody could have a piece of land. Now, unfortunately, 40 years later, things aren't so good again, and those revolutionary leaders have become dictators. Okay. Same guy. I met him. But when we were there in 1984, the U.S. was organizing what were called Contras, people right. who had left the country. And our CIA was organizing them and training them in Honduras to come back and shoot farmers, to shoot right. the peasants
right.
when they were picking coffee and cotton so they could destroy the economy.
Right.
Think how cynical that is.
Right.
And we surmised, we just theorized that that was a CIA operation and that it was being run out of the U.S. Embassy in Honduras. And 2 years later, that was all validated in the Iran-Contra hearings.
Okay.
So we started thinking, well, if groups of us go and stay in those villages during the cotton and coffee harvests, the Contras will stay away. So in the first week of January of 1984, I was off to Nicaragua.
84, I was 14. I'm sorry.
No.
I was a rambunctious 14. I knew nothing about nothing.
And so what we found was over a 7-year period that if there were delegations staying in those villages, and we had to, I was in a village, we had to go out and pick cotton 6 days a week. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm sure people who've picked cotton know that that's a hard job. Your fingers get cut right. up, and you know, we'd turn in our bags at lunchtime, and there'd be maybe a third as full as the Nicaraguans who were turning in their bags.
Right, right.
And then on Sundays, we got to play baseball, because baseball is the national sport there.
Okay.
So, but the point is that those villages were never attacked by the Contra when there were delegations there. So that got me thinking about it. And then, you know, my wife Georgia and I raised a big family and, you know, had all kinds of occupations and, you know, surviving and getting by like lots of people. And so that idea just lurked in the back of my head. Mm-hmm. And then in 1997, I got a fellowship to go off and study. And I was in a school in downtown Oakland.
Okay.
And I was in a class on the mystics. And there was a section that had just begun on Rumi, the 13th century Persian poet. Okay. Look him up. He is vexing. Rumi, R-U-M-I.
Okay, so the mystics, are you talking about like Sufis or?
He was one of the original Sufis.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the Sufis. Yes, I'm familiar with their information. Bawa Mahawadeen out of Detroit, out of Michigan. I think that's where their base is. Yes, I'm familiar.
And a Sufi was teaching this class.
Oh, okay.
And it was the first day of class.
Okay.
And I'm sitting there with my notebook that I always carry with me.
Okay.
And I'm daydreaming during class, and I hear her say, "And your job is to enter the heart of your enemy." Mm. And she's staring at me. She didn't know me. I didn't know her. And I quickly looked to see if the other students were still there. They were. And I wrote in my notebook, "Enter the heart of my enemy. That's a good place to rip it out." And then further down the page, I wrote, "Don't go back to sleep. This could change your life." And Manu, from that moment on, I was challenged by the way that I worked, by the way that I saw life, in a dualistic way. It was always us versus them, good versus evil, right versus wrong. 50% plus one means we kick their butt. And everywhere I turned, I was challenged by my very cells to start understanding the world from our place of unity.
Right.
And that took me to places I never imagined. I ended up on this fellowship going to a Buddhist monastery. This was the Bush Foundation. They'd kind of given up on me by then. Because they're paying people to go to Harvard.
Yeah.
Bush, I'm saying I'm headed for a Buddhist monastery. But there, it was run by a Vietnamese monk, Thich Nhat Hanh. And he was saying, by then it was 1998, that we were no longer at a place where we could afford to take sides. That the stakes were too high. I mean, he saw all of what we're seeing now 20 years ago. And so when I was leaving Plum Village, I wrote in my notebook a thought piece on a nonviolent peace force. And I guess, the rest just unfolded. When the student's ready, the teacher appeared.
Yeah, the stakes are too high to take sides.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. The beginning of this year, I was fortunate enough to receive a fellowship from Vocal out of Denver. It's Vocal Fellowship. And, my first fellowship, my first venture outside of the workforce. And I always say that I'm like 10 years old in doing this work, because when I made a change, a lifestyle change, it was 10 years ago. And from that choice, everything else happened, right? This how, it's been a journey. And we never really know, like, what we'll receive on that journey and on that path, but going down it with pure heart and our intentions, right?
Yeah.
I think that's what exposes us to what we need to be exposed to. So this
just
is kind of like...
Stay open.
Just stay open, open, right? Stay open, yeah. Right? Don't come into it thinking you know anything, because I thought that I knew about lifestyle recovery. Right? But when I start studying addictions, that centered me to, it's all choices and decisions, thought processes, right? Based on information or based on feelings or emotions or, based on unresolved issues, trauma and all that, right?
Yeah.
But knowing that you know, from the environment that I came up in and I was born and raised in, which is Atlanta during the crack era, right? I came up in the 70s and the 80s. Knowing that it wasn't just the individuals who was using the drugs that was the addicts. Because the, you know, the dealers had a mentality of staying stuck. The police had a, you know, we had a whole lot of money put into, well, it was taken out of the mental health institution and put into, you know, the prison industrial complex. And the,
that was the war on drugs, right?
Right. But yeah, with that war, it created not only a higher sense of dependency, not just on drugs, but systems. And systems came in, and systems have a way of, you know, destroying good, healthy cultures.
Yep.
Right? So, so with my fellowship, and I wrote that down. The stakes are too high to take sides, because there's a lot of people taking sides, and there's still that us against them. Right? It still puts humanity either at a sub level from something else that we can't quite identify and put our finger on, or we're breaking humanity up according to our own biases, both of which are wrong. Right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, we had like 25 minutes on this, and you know, you said a lot of things that was very important, and how I hear them is they're coming from a place of what you value as an individual, right? What you value as a person, you know. Yes. And I know that, and you know, even doing the work with restorative justice and having the uncomfortable conversations around implicit biases, starting out. And even in the healing circles, we have integrated the format of starting out with your values as an individual. Before we even go to talk about anything, you know, we start out with our values, because a lot of times we get caught up in situations and circumstances that may not be aligned with our values and will lead us down a path where we'll be just following somebody else's lead that's creating the chaos, right? And we'll be soldiers in that chaos, right?
If you don't stand for something, you're gonna fall for anything.
Yeah, you're gonna fall for it all.
Yeah.
Right? So if you can give me like two personal values that you have, that you have identified yourself with having and using those to reflect, kind of like in what you do. Can you give me like two?
Well, the one would be the unity of all things, all beings.
The unity of all beings.
Yeah. And we're just starting to understand that. You know, they're understanding now how trees communicate with each other through their roots. You know, it's just a huge, huge mystery out there that we're just starting to glimpse. And of course, nonviolence, that if we are going to survive, like Dr. King said in 1967 in his speech Beyond Vietnam, the choice is between nonviolence and non-existence. And if we're going to survive, and I don't think that that's a total been decided, I think that we're on a precipice of survival as a species. We will do that nonviolently.
Right.
And underneath that is love. When you scratch it all away, it's love.
Thank you for that. Thank you for that.